5 years ago, I was paying $65 a month for my subscriptions. Today, those same subscriptions cost $111, and I don't even use half of them anymore. That's why now I use Rocket Money to manage my subscriptions for me. The app gives you a list of all your subscriptions and reminds you of upcoming payments so you're not hit with any surprise charges. On top of that, it also sends you alerts when subscription prices go up, so you always know the price you're paying. If you decide you no longer want a subscription, you can cancel it right from the app. No customer service needed. And the best part is, Rocket Money even reaches out and tries to get you refunded for some of the money you lost. On average, people that cancel their subscriptions with Rocket Money save $378 a year. And overall, Rocket Money has saved its members $880 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to get stronger just around the corner, so you can give everything you've got. Whether you want to crush a few reps before class with our expanded strength equipment or sweat it out on your way home from work, with over 2,800 locations, there's a Planet Fitness close to you, and most are open 24 hours. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends January 30th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
October 27th, 1989. 10-year-old Amy Mihaljevic vanished after school from a shopping center in Bay Village, Ohio. Detectives would later learn that she had been lured there by a man pretending to know her family. For months, Amy's parents, investigators, and the entire community searched for answers, hoping she would be found alive. Then, in 1990, Amy's body was discovered in a remote field in Ashland County, Ohio. Her death was ruled a homicide, but more than three decades later, Amy's murder remains unsolved, leaving everyone wondering who killed Amy Mihaljevic. Hey everyone, welcome back to Detective Perspective. My name is Derek Levasseur. I'm a licensed private investigator and former police detective. Each week I'll be covering an unsolved case in story format. I'll then give you my perspective on the investigation and provide contact information for the individuals or organizations connected to the case so that if you have any tips, you can contact them directly and maybe you can help solve a case. So if you're someone who's interested in true crime, specifically unsolved cases, and you would like to hear my opinion on those investigations, please consider subscribing whether you're watching on YouTube or listening on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or whatever platform you use. Okay, we're going to be talking about Amy's case tonight. This is a highly requested story, and full disclosure, there's a lot of info on this case. So like we always do, I'm going to focus on the main facts. And candidly, I hate everything about this case. I have a 13-year-old and a 10-year-old daughter, and the timing in which I'm covering this case is both the worst and the best at the same time. Just a week ago, I was having a minor disagreement with my oldest daughter, Tenley, because she wanted to have her friend's nanny pick her up after school and bring her to a local shopping center to do some shopping before they came home. They needed some outfits for a school project, and I do quotations on that because any parents out there know, it might have something to do with that, but there's definitely more to the story. And unfortunately for her, I said no. I didn't know the nanny, although she's been watching her friend for 10 years, and I just didn't feel comfortable. And it's not that I don't trust the nanny, but it's not me. And I'm not there to be able to at least stay in the background and make sure she's okay. Now, I know that is the definition of a helicopter parent. But unfortunately for me, I'm faced with cases that we're covering tonight all the time. And I'd rather her be a little upset with me because I'm, a little bit more controlling than be in a position where I'm left wondering, what if? And there's nothing wrong with any parents that have done that, have decided to let their kids go alone and do their own thing. Dangers are everywhere. It can happen to anyone. But if I have the ability to be around, that's what I'm going to do. And that's not always the case. Sometimes I can't be there and I have to, I guess, roll the dice a little bit, allow them a little bit more freedom, do my due diligence, make sure I know the people they're with, make sure I have phone numbers and emails for everybody who's going to be around, and, you know, make sure the trackers are on, go over all the stuff that I go over with her whenever she's by herself, and hope for the best, pray for the best, because the world's a dangerous place right now. This particular case is one that is a nightmare for me, because not only do you have an abduction and a murder, but you also have a moment in this story where Amy's going to have a brief conversation with her mother after she's already been abducted. I don't know what Amy's mindset was at that point, and we're going to talk about that when we get there, but I just can't imagine being in that position. And Amy's mother is no longer with us, but still, that burden of carrying that her entire life until she passed, I wouldn't wish it on my worst enemy. And to be honest with you, as I was reading it and thinking about Amy in that moment and what was going through her mind, I broke down. I was crying. And I actually called Tenley, who was in the shower and was mad at me for calling her. But I said, hey, you know what I'm covering this week? And I gave her a brief overview of Amy's case. And this isn't the first time I've done this, because I want her to understand why I am the way that I am. I'm not saying it's right, but I can't help it. I just know too much. And it's probably not for my own good, but I'd like to look at it as being educated, being informed, looking at history, seeing the modus operandi of these monsters, and using it to my advantage going forward by not putting myself or my kids in a position where it can happen to them. And I think everybody who's ever experienced tragedy like this, if they could tell you one thing, they would tell you that. Learn from my experience. Don't let it happen to you. So that's one of the reasons we're covering it. The other reason is there's still hope here. There's going to be some things that we're going to talk about that may potentially lead to the person responsible for this. And at minimum, I want you all to be aware of it if you're not already, so that if you're from that area and something stands out to you when I talk about it, you can come forward with that information if you think it's going to be helpful. I have a lot to cover. I don't want to waste any more time. Let's dive into this week's case. Amy Renee Mihaljevic was born on December 11th, 1978 to her parents Margaret and Mark. She grew up in Bay Village, a quiet suburb just outside of Cleveland, Ohio, and she was especially close to her family. Amy had a brother, Jason, who was 3 years older than her, and the two siblings spent a lot of time together. Those who knew Amy described her as bright and thoughtful. She was friendly with people she knew well, but more reserved around others. She loved to draw and spent hours watching her favorite television show, The Golden Girls. Amy adored animals, especially her dog Jake, and she often talked about wanting to become a veterinarian someday. By October of 1989, Amy was 10 years old and a fifth grade student at Bay Middle School, where she was part of the gifted program. Every school day, Amy and Jason walked to and from school, though not always together. Because both parents worked outside the home, there was one strict rule. Once they were both home from school, they were to call their mom at work. She worked at Trading Times magazine, so that she would know they were home safe. On October 27th, at approximately 3:10 p.m., Margaret received an after-school call from Jason, as expected. But he told her he had arrived home from school and Amy wasn't there yet. Margaret wasn't immediately alarmed because Amy had already told her that she planned to attend choir tryouts after school, so Margaret had just assumed she was still there. She told Jason to call her back if Amy wasn't home by 3:30 p.m. Some sources say that when Amy still hadn't returned by 3:30, Jason did call his mom again and Margaret started packing her things up and was getting ready to leave, but right when she was doing that, she received another call, and this time, it was from Amy herself. I do want to note, according to police records, it's unknown if Jason really did call his mom for a second time. All they do know for sure is that at around 3:30 p.m., Amy did call Margaret. Now, during this call, they only spoke briefly, then said goodbye and see you soon. And according to Margaret, Amy sounded completely normal, so she assumed that she was calling from home like usual. She had no idea she'd never speak to Amy again. Margaret finished her workday and drove home, arriving sometime before 5:30 p.m. She fully expected to find Amy. Instead, only Jason was there. Margaret immediately began calling friends and neighbors, hoping someone had seen her daughter, but no one had. She then retraced Amy's usual route from school, and when she reached the bike rack, she found Amy's bike still locked in place. That's when Margaret knew something was very wrong. Margaret went directly to the Bay Village Police Department and reported Amy missing. A large-scale search didn't begin right away, and that was mainly due to the fact that Bay Village was a community where violent crimes were rare, and officers hoped this was just a misunderstanding and that Amy would return on her own. Even though they didn't start a search right away, police took the report seriously enough to follow Margaret back to the house as everyone waited and hoped that Amy would call or walk back through the door. According to CBS, by 7 p.m., there was still no sign of Amy, and at that point, a full search effort was launched. While officers searched, detectives began working to determine the last confirmed sighting of Amy. They learned that at approximately 2:15 p.m., about 10 minutes after school let out, two 10-year-old students saw Amy standing near a pole outside a Baskin-Robbins and a barbershop at Bay Village Square, a small shopping center that sat directly across the street from the police station. Now, this Bay Village Square was a very known location, and students would frequently walk there after school to get some ice cream, so very common place for students to be around after school. The students said Amy appeared to be waiting for someone, and they watched as an adult male approached her, and the two began talking. The witnesses saw Amy walking through the parking lot with the man, but unfortunately, they didn't see where the pair went or if they got into a vehicle. Obviously, this information immediately concerned detectives, but unfortunately, there was no surveillance footage from the area, so investigators couldn't independently verify what the students reported seeing. So law enforcement continued interviewing students, and additional information soon emerged. According to WKYC, several of Amy's classmates said that earlier that day, Amy told them she had a secret. She said she was going to meet a man after school, someone she described as a co-worker of her mom's. Amy told her friends that the man had called her at home several times. He said Margaret had just received a promotion at work and asked Amy to help him pick out a gift to celebrate. The plan was for him to meet Amy at Bay Village Square on October 27th, pick her up, and then take her to the mall to shop for the present. Now, the man also told Amy that the trip was to be kept a secret so it wouldn't spoil the surprise. When detectives learned this, they went directly to Amy's parents and her brother, and none of them had any knowledge of the supposed co-worker, the phone calls, or the shopping plans. Jason did tell investigators that he remembered overhearing Amy speaking with the man on the phone in the past, but didn't know who the caller was or what they had discussed. At that point, detectives were faced with a chilling realization. Someone had gained Amy's trust and used it against her. She had been abducted. We can kind of go back and break down what I've talked about so far, because it was a lot. First off, I know some people might be turning their head a little bit when I say that law enforcement didn't immediately start a large-scale search. I'm sure there was stuff going on. They were reaching out to friends and family. They were following Margaret. They were following up with her. They didn't just shoo her off. Do I think in hindsight, they maybe could have sent some people out to just search particular areas where Amy might have gone? Sure. Is it possible they did do that? Absolutely. I also thought about roadblocks, and would that have been possible? Depending on how many roads led in and out of that town, maybe. But how big of a radius do you do? How far has Amy gotten by that point? We're now looking at 5:30, 6 o'clock, right? The last time they've heard from her was at 3:30, and it looks like she was abducted way before that. So 2-3 hours, she could have been in another state by that point. Because you have to remember, at this point, when Margaret came into the station, they didn't know about Bay Village Square. They didn't know that she was seen with an adult male. All they knew was that she called her mom at 3:30, the bike was still in the bike rack, and she wasn't there. So it's possible she could have been at a friend's house, a neighbor's house, something. And that was the hope. And I'm not going to criticize them too much, because it's always easy to play Monday morning quarterback. And there's a lot of cases where I got to come down hard on them. They didn't do their job and it could have made a difference. I don't know if that's the case here, especially with what we know now. I think they handled it for the most part right away, especially if we come to learn that even though they weren't out there doing a search of all the woods and the roads at that time, they were out there doing a preliminary search, reaching out to friends, neighbors to see if anyone had seen or heard from Amy. If that's the case and they're in contact with Margaret, the mother at the home, also waiting for Amy's return, then I'm okay with it. I'm happy with the way they handled it. Maybe you won't be. If you're not, weigh in down in the comments. Let me know in a review. I'm fine with that. But that's my initial perspective on it. Now, as far as what we know now, it's bad. It's really bad. We know that this guy has been doing his research. This wasn't just a random day where he saw Amy in a parking lot and decided to grab her. There was some thought put into this. And this wasn't the first girl that he had reached out to. So this guy was planning this for a while and probably had something in place for that day where he was going to get out of the town as quickly as possible. And I want to go back to the phone call because that's the thing that I struggled with as I thought about it over and over and over and over. And to me, I don't think at that point when Amy made the phone call, she knew how much trouble she was in. I think at that point, because of circumstances that I'm going to talk to you about in a little bit, she was under the impression that she was still carrying out this secret for her mom. And so when she called and she was calm, cool, and collected, that was because she was putting on an act so her mom wouldn't figure out that she was out getting a surprise for her. And as weird as this sounds, and you may feel differently, that made me feel just a smidge better, because the thought of her being held against her will, making that call to her mom, wanting to tell her what was currently going on, but not being able to, it broke me. And I'm not going to get emotional again, but I didn't like it. I still don't like this case for many reasons that we're going to learn about. And you already know from the trailer, but I don't know, something about it, like her in that final moment, talking to her mom, still being in a good place and ending on that note, to me, just made me feel a little better, but not good, not good at all. So once detectives understood that Amy had been abducted, the investigation escalated quickly. Bay Village Police contacted the FBI, went public to ask for help, and began actively searching for the person responsible. They had no immediate leads on who the man could be. What they did have were a few critical clues. The caller knew where Amy's mother worked, and he knew when Amy would be home alone without her parents, which would be the perfect time to call. He also appeared to know that Amy called her mom every day after school, and that failing to do so would raise concern. Investigators believe that's likely why Amy was allowed to make that call that afternoon, even after she had been abducted. And that goes back to what I was just saying, which is why I believe her abductor let her call. He probably said to her, "Hey, is there anything you normally do when you get home?" And she said, "Yeah, I usually call my mom to let her know that I'm there." So at that point, he probably said, "Okay, well, let's call her real quick so that way she doesn't know that we're about to surprise her." And obviously, Amy agreed to do so, and that's what transpired. At least that's why it all makes sense to me, because I don't see a 10-year-old girl being in a predicament where she knows she's in a lot of trouble and being able to keep her composure on the phone long enough where her mother wouldn't have detected something was off, something was wrong, and maybe ask a follow-up question like, "Hey, is everything okay?" Absolutely nothing. And nobody knows Amy better than her mother. So the fact that there were no red flags, according to Margaret, that means a lot. I think the only way Amy would be able to pull that off would be if she didn't know what was actually going on. And detectives did attempt to determine where that call came from, but they were never able to trace it. You got to remember, this is 1989. Things were a lot different, unfortunately. It's not like it is today. So although I wish it happened in 2026, we can only play the hand we're dealt. And unfortunately, with the technology at the time, there wasn't much you could do. However, they did receive a report from a woman who said she saw a girl resembling Amy at the Westgate Mall, which was approximately 6 miles from where Amy was last seen, and this was around 3:30 p.m. The woman said that the girl was walking in the food court with an adult man, so could be someone else, but based on what we know, the proximity and who she was last seen with, and around the same time when the call was made, it's a high likelihood that the woman had actually seen Amy with her abductor. And again, unfortunately, due to the lack of technology and surveillance footage, law enforcement was never able to confirm or rule out this tip. Still, investigators have always said it is possible that the girl this woman saw was in fact Amy, and that she made the call to her mom from a payphone at the mall. And to me, that all makes sense. It all tracks, right? She was seen in close proximity to the mall, and she was seen at the mall around the time she made a phone call, which would align because they didn't have cell phones then, so she had to be at some public place in order to make that phone call. And when you think about the illusion that this guy made, he basically said, hey, we're going to go get a gift for your mom at the mall. Well, it would make sense that he brought her to the mall, and that lowered her guard because everything was checking out. And so she was willing to make that call to her mom and lie about where she was in order to keep the secret going. Is it possible it's not her? Of course. But to me, it does track. It does line up. As the search for Amy continued, detectives worked closely with the two students who reported seeing her outside Baskin-Robbins. Based on their statements, police developed a description of the man they saw. He was described as a white male between the ages of 30 and 35 years old, approximately 5'8 to 5'10" tall, with a medium build. He had dark hair, possibly curly, with a bald spot toward the top or back of his head. Witnesses also noted a small amount of beard growth and said he may have been wearing round glasses and a tan jacket. Based on that description, a composite sketch was created and shown to Amy's family, but they didn't recognize the man. The sketch was later released to the public, but the man has never been identified. Investigators have said that they are unsure how accurate the sketch is and are not relying heavily on it. And that's mostly due to the fact that you have to consider the witnesses. These are 10-year-old students. You would like to think that they would be able to give you an accurate description, and maybe they did. But I know, speaking from my own experience with my own 10-year-old, if I were to ask her to describe someone she had seen for only a couple seconds, more than likely the person would look like Big Bird when she was done with it. I'm not trying to be funny here, but that's the reality of it. Love you, Peyton, but that's more than likely what I would be left with. So I understand why they're not putting too much weight on this initial sketch. It makes perfect sense. And we have a lot more to cover. Obviously, you know, this is not going to end well, or we wouldn't be here covering it. And we're going to talk about some evidence that may actually help us solve this case. We're going to do that right after this break. Ever wake up sweaty, freezing, or just uncomfortable? The temperature in your bedroom can make or break your sleep. That's why I switched to Miracle Made sheets. They're inspired by NASA technology and use silver-infused temperature-regulating fabric to help keep you at the perfect temperature all night long. And thanks to their antibacterial silver technology, Miracle Made sheets stay cleaner and fresher up to 3 times longer than regular sheets. That means fewer odors, fewer wash cycles, and way less laundry. And the most important part, at least to me, they have to feel good, right? I mean, all that other stuff really doesn't matter if they don't feel good, so I'm happy to report they feel great. And they feel just as nice, if not nicer, than some of the sheets I've slept on in 5-star hotels, but without the steep price tag. So yes, they're smooth, they're breathable, and ridiculously comfortable. They're also great for your skin. All that hidden bacteria that you find in regular sheets, well, it can clog your pores. It can cause breakouts, and last time I checked, nobody wants either of those things. But with Miracle Made's antibacterial design, it helps you sleep cleaner and clearer night after night. So upgrade your sleep or give the gift of better rest with Miracle Made. All you have to do is go to trymiracle.com/detective to try Miracle Made sheets today. You'll save over 40%, and when you use my promo code DETECTIVE, you'll get an extra 20% off, plus a free 3-piece towel set. They make an amazing gift. And with their 30-day money-back guarantee, there's really no risk. That's trymiracle.com/detective at checkout. Thanks to Miracle Made for sponsoring this episode. Okay, we're back. And as the search moved into the second day, detectives interviewed Amy's family, friends, neighbors, and anyone who could remotely be considered a suspect. Despite those efforts, no leads emerged. Investigators then turned their attention to identifying other potential victims. Questionnaires were sent out to multiple schools, and detectives learned that at least 2 other 10-year-old girls had received phone calls that closely resembled the ones Amy told her friends about. One girl reported that the man introduced himself as her mother's boss, using the correct name. He said her mom was getting a promotion and told her he was unsure what to buy as a gift. He asked to pick her up after school so she could help him choose a surprise, but when the girl began telling her brother about the call, the man became angry and said, quote, "You're going to ruin it." She told the man she couldn't go, and he hung up. The second girl reported a similar circumstance. She further said the caller was, quote, "very persuasive" and contacted her multiple times when her mother was not home. She also said he had a specific knowledge about her family. His attempts failed when she said she wanted to check in with her father first. According to the media, detectives searched for a connection between the girls who received these calls and identified one shared link, the Lake Erie Nature and Science Center in Bay Village. Now, what's interesting here is that the center kept a guest book where visitors wrote their names and addresses, but when detectives attempted to locate the guest book, it was missing, and it has never been recovered. However, this wasn't a complete loss because after identifying that connection, investigators spoke with additional girls who had visited the center and learned that some of them had also received similar phone calls, but none of them met with the man, thank God. Now, you would think this lead was very strong, and it is. And I wish I could tell you that it led somewhere, but unfortunately, it didn't. And as we were kind of going over this, Shannon, the one who's editing this video right now, was like, why couldn't they set up like a catch a predator style sting and catch him that way? And that would be a good idea to try and lure him back out to do this again to someone he sees as an easy target. But I have to imagine that at this point, he's not going to attack the same area twice. He knows that they're on to him. And I'm going to talk about my profile of this suspect at the end of this episode. But I would imagine that this was a one-time deal and he probably moved on to another location. That being said, as an investigator, it wouldn't stop me from reaching out to other parts of the country and seeing if any other departments had run into something where the suspect was reaching out to young girls who attended a daycare center or a school. Maybe they did meet up with them. Maybe they survived that encounter. There could be someone who carried out the same methodology in another part of the country years before Amy's disappearance. And now with this new information to add to it, we may be able to link someone who was identified then to someone currently living in Ohio at the time of Amy's disappearance. It's a long shot. It's a very low percentage that it would lead anywhere, but we've had circumstances before where it was also a long shot, but the detective did the work and it ultimately paid off. So I wouldn't say a catch a predator style sting would work here because again, more than likely they're going to know that law enforcement's onto it and looking for it, but it doesn't mean that this person hadn't done it before Amy and didn't do it after in another part of the country. And that needs to be investigated. As the search for Amy went on for days, weeks, and even months, there was no sign of her or the person who had taken her. Then, on February 8th, 1990, a woman out jogging along County Road 1181 in remote Ashland County, Ohio, made a devastating discovery. Lying next to a large field roughly 50 miles from where Amy was abducted was the decomposing body of a young girl. Police rushed to the scene and quickly confirmed that the remains did in fact belong to Amy Mihaljevic. It was the outcome no one had been hoping for. Investigators noted that Amy was still wearing the shirt and pants she had on the day she disappeared, though it is important to note that based on what the media has said, investigators believe that her clothing had been taken off and then put back on. Several personal items she was wearing the day she went missing have never been recovered, including the boots she was wearing, turquoise earrings shaped like horse heads, a denim backpack, and a binder with, quote, "Buick Best in Class" written on it. An autopsy later revealed that Amy had eaten one last meal after she was abducted, possibly more. There were indications of sexual assault, and she had suffered blunt force trauma to the left side of her head and multiple stab wounds to the left side of her neck. Medical examiners were unable to determine the exact cause of death, but estimated Amy had been killed within a week of her abduction. Based on the condition of her remains, investigators believe she had been in the field since that time. I do want to go back to the scene where Amy was found. While there, detectives noted that the location was not somewhere a person would just stumble upon it. The area was well off the highway, extremely remote, and difficult to access. Investigators believe this was significant, suggesting the person responsible was familiar with the area. They conducted a thorough search within a 1 mile radius of where Amy's body was discovered, collecting anything that looked even remotely connected to Amy's case. Not all of the findings from the search have been released publicly, but investigators have said they located a curtain in a ditch approximately 300 yards away from Amy's body. The curtain was described as pea green and crudely homemade. It appeared to be fashioned from something like a large quilt or a bed covering, possibly taken from a hotel room, and very poorly altered into a curtain. Detectives believe that Amy could have been wrapped in it at some point, though they couldn't be sure due to the limited technology at the time. The curtain, along with anything else that was found, including Amy's clothes, were collected as evidence and kept in storage until technology could catch up. This was a common occurrence back in the 90s, back in the 80s. I know with Michelle Norris, 1988, same thing happened where, although the technology at the time couldn't be used to help filter out what the evidence actually meant, they knew even then that if they collected it properly and preserved it in a way that it could be used later, technology would eventually catch up. And that's even the case today. There are things that are being collected now that still can't be utilized, even with the current technology that we have. But there's one thing for certain. As we evolve as a society, and as DNA technology and AI gets better, things that didn't appear to have significance at the time, based on our limitations, will be the key factor in solving a case down the road. And that'll always be true. So the number one thing that any investigator can take from this case or any other cases is, when you have something, even if it doesn't hold a lot of value at the time, you need to treat it like it does. Because in the future, how you preserve that evidence may decide whether the case is solved or not. In addition to canvassing the area for physical evidence, they also reached out to anyone in the area to see if they saw anything suspicious. And through those interactions, they learned about an Oldsmobile that had been seen driving through an intersection near the field on the same day Amy's body was found. According to ABC, another witness reported seeing a man in his mid-20s to early 30s standing near a dark blue hatchback with the rear hatch open approximately 13 hours before the body was discovered. A sketch of this man was later created and released, but unfortunately, again, these leads went nowhere, and years passed with little movement in the case. And as I mentioned earlier, tragically in 2001, Amy's mother, Margaret, died at the age of 54. She was laid to rest beside her daughter. And as far as Amy's father, Mark, and her brother, Jason, they continued advocating for answers along local and federal law enforcement. There were few public updates until the early 2010s, when former FBI agent Phil Tornsey came out of retirement to continue working Amy's case. He re-examined all the evidence to determine what could be tested using advances in forensic technology and submitted multiple items for analysis. Now, over the past decade, a lot of this evidence has been tested and retested, so I'm just going to talk about everything they found during that time, starting with Amy's clothes. According to Crime Stoppers, DNA found on Amy's clothing was determined to belong to a male. However, the amount recovered was too small to develop into a usable profile. Additionally, fibers recovered from Amy's clothing were consistent with a tan-colored automobile carpet manufactured between 1975 and 1978, most likely from a GM vehicle. Why is that important? Well, I just mentioned an Oldsmobile a few minutes ago, which was spotted by a witness. An Oldsmobile was made by GM. So it gives more credibility to not only this witness, but also to the possibility that what they saw was in fact the suspect's vehicle. So it's not going to help solve the case right there, but if we identify a person, this is one of those factors that you can go back and cross-reference. Let's go back to that curtain that was recovered near the scene, because I do think that's significant as well, because up until this point, investigators thought the curtain was related to Amy's case, but they couldn't be 100% sure. Thankfully, the lab was able to locate dog hair and human hair on the curtain. Now, the dog hair was matched to Amy's dog, Jake, which I mentioned earlier, and some of the human hairs were determined to belong to Amy, officially confirming the curtain's connection to her abduction and murder. In addition, three male human hairs, possibly from the killer, were also found on the curtain. Unfortunately, the hairs have been described as extremely fragile, limiting the testing that can be done at this time. However, like I was just saying, with the advancements in science and technology, even though there's not much that can be done right now, it doesn't mean something won't be able to be done in the future. And I would say closer to the immediate future than that far down the road. We're advancing so quick now. I wouldn't be surprised if there's someone out there right now who listens or watches this episode and says, hey, I'm an expert in mitochondrial DNA, and we've been experimenting with hair that's strongly degraded, and I'm able to do something with that. I'm going to reach out. It wouldn't shock me in the least, and that's the reason we cover these cases. Okay, so let's fast forward to October 2021. By that point, 32 years had passed since Amy was abducted and murdered. That fall, investigators provided an update to 19 News, and they spoke about where they were at with the DNA testing, which we just talked about. They also brought up the topic of potential suspects, saying, quote, there are several people we are still looking at today as suspects for the case. Some of them have came to our attention recently, and some of them have been suspects for years and decades. As you would expect, investigators declined to name any suspects or persons of interest, and to this day, they still haven't released any further details. What they have said is that they've collected DNA swabs from approximately 250 individuals. Now, those profiles are being compared against the limited forensic evidence in Amy's case, and so far, none have resulted in a match. But they are hopeful that will change. Unfortunately, there have been no other major updates in Amy's case. 2025 marked 36 years since she was tragically murdered. Her family and investigators continue searching for answers, hoping this will be the year they get justice for Amy. All right, let's dive into this perspective, and I want to elaborate on a couple of the things and recap some of the information I gave during the episode, because I think there's a couple things that we can extract from what we do know. To me, it's blatantly obvious that this person was familiar with this area and may have resided there for at least an extended period of time. Did they live there their entire life? I don't know. They could have moved to this location to do exactly what they did, but they were there for a while. And we know that because they were targeting a specific group of people. This Lake Erie Nature and Science Center in Bay Village appears to be the target location, and you have to ask yourself, what's the connection to our suspect? Did they have a child that attended there? Were they an employee? Or on one particular day, did they just stop in as a quote-unquote visitor checking out the center for their own child? That's also possible, but the fact that the guest book was missing is such a loss for investigators, because there's so much that could have been done with that. You could have gone through that book one by one, ruling people out by confirming alibis, and hopefully you would have been left with a short list of people that you could have looked into deeper. And based on some of the other information we have, like the fact that there was potentially an Oldsmobile involved, you can cross-reference that information and see if something pops. But without the guest book, it's like it didn't even happen. You can't go in there, and there's no way to really confirm who entered that building and what they were there for. So huge loss, and it was a punch to the gut when I got to that part and learned that the guest book was no longer around. And I hope it's not something sinister. I hope that this guy wasn't smart enough to grab it before investigators got a hold of it. But if he was able to, it does make me wonder, what's his connection to the school? Was he someone who would have access to the guest book and would be able to remove it without anybody noticing? And that goes back to the location of the guest book. I know at my daughter's school, and I'm not going to describe it perfectly for security reasons, but it's in the presence of someone where if you did something to the book, they're going to notice. It's a big book. It's right there. If you take it and try to walk out of there, they're going to be like, hey, what are you doing? So maybe that was the case here. Maybe it wasn't. Again, different times. I would love to know more about it. I would kill for the opportunity to be a fly on the wall to see what was done to track down this guest book and to see if it really does look like the suspect was the one who took it, or was it an administrative F-up where they're just not saying it publicly because they don't want the backlash to come back on the center? Trust me, that's also possible as well. So what can we deduce from this? Well, clearly the suspect was frequenting this place, hanging around the location, identifying multiple children, probably watching them be picked up. He was following them back to their homes and then stalking them for days, maybe even weeks, maybe months, seeing the routine, seeing the schedule, seeing when the parents were there and when they weren't there, following them to work to find out what their place of employment was, learning when was the most vulnerable time to attack these children. And this would have taken some time. And he was also hedging his bets. He wasn't just focusing on one girl. He was focusing on multiple children, knowing that more than likely he was going to have a bunch of failures. And he wanted to have multiple irons in the fire so that if two went down, he still had other opportunities. And I'm sure in his mind, he was hoping that it would happen quickly so that before anyone else realized what was going on, he would already be able to carry out his plan, which unfortunately is exactly what happened. He was able to get her off school property, get her in his car, and keep her calm enough to call her mother and keep their concerns down, which allotted him a huge window of time where he could escape the area without anyone even looking for Amy. And that is the small argument that can be made where if they're doing the search initially, maybe it makes a difference. Although I will say, based on the time frame that we have, they're at the mall at 3:30 when she makes the call to Margaret. Maybe they're there 30 minutes. I would say probably even less. But let's just say 4 o'clock. Now they get in the car, and that's when Amy finds out that this is not what it appears to be. I'm sure at that point she's restrained and she's unable to do anything. And then it's an hour to an hour and a half drive before Margaret realizes that something is wrong. Now, by the time she gets to the police station around 5:30, 6 o'clock, you're looking at almost 2 hours. And the radius that you would have to cover at that time, it would more than likely be physically impossible for that local police department. But we'll never know. We'll never know if it could have made a difference. And again, just to reiterate, I don't think that it did. I think that they handled it the way they thought was appropriate based on the times, based on the circumstances of what they knew when they knew it. And they didn't even wait until learning that she had been seen with an adult male. They initiated that search as soon as she didn't come home around 7 p.m. So overall, based on all the cases that we've covered, I give them a pass here. I can't sit here and be a hypocrite and say I might not have done the same thing based on the circumstances. So I don't think that was a factor in this case. What is a factor is that this guy knew what he was doing, knew the area, felt confident enough to grab her right across from the police station. Yes, it was calm and she didn't put up a fight, but still you run the risk of the police officer coming across from the police station to grab an ice cream and seeing your face. So the ball's on this guy, to put it bluntly. It's out there, and it does make me think that he's not someone who was known to the community that well. So even if he lived there, he was a recluse, because if he was someone who was known to everybody who frequented the area, he would be less inclined to be seen with Amy in a public area, because now it's not some strange man that she's seen with. It's Johnny from down the street or James from church. So I don't think he would put himself in that position if he had a lot of friends or family around there. That's what I'm trying to say. He can be from that area and still be a stranger to most of the people who live there. So where does that leave us? It's about the DNA. Fortunately, we have it in this case. We need science and technology to come through for us and find a match, whether it's a match directly to the suspect or a familial match. That's all we need, because from there, we can take the evidence we do have and reverse engineer it. Let's say we identify a guy and he's from the area, maybe lived in this location for, who knows, 3 to 5 years, maybe longer, doesn't really matter. He was in Bay Village for an extended period of time. Then we learn that he had some type of connection to the Lake Erie Nature and Science Center. Then we do an even deeper dive and we learn that at the time of Amy's disappearance, he owned a 1975 to 1978 Oldsmobile. And if we're really lucky, we find that he has some unknown connection to this Ashland County, where he would know the topography of the area and where he could dump a body that wouldn't be found for a long enough time for him to get out of there. That's perfect scenario. We don't need all of those points, just a few of them. But in order to get there, we first have to identify the DNA. Who does it belong to? make that match, and we solve this case. But what if the DNA's a miss? Do we just pack it up and go home? Absolutely not. There's still a lot here. I've provided you with a lot of detailed information, and it may not make sense to you or I, but there could be someone out there right now who's saying, yeah, that person checks most of those boxes. They were around that learning center during that time. They were in Bay Village. They owned an Oldsmobile that was between 1975 and 1978. And yeah, they did have a connection to Ashland County. Maybe I should call it in. I don't know if they did anything, but I at least should put it on someone's radar. And maybe they make that call. And then by making that call, they're able to get a DNA profile from that. Or again, if the DNA is not working, maybe that person's already on their suspect list for another reason. And now they can start vetting that person's criminal history, where they have lived throughout the country, and see if there were any other crimes in those areas that were similar to what happened to Amy. And honestly, that's how it starts. Just one small thing that may be insignificant to 99% of the population, but to the investigators working the case, that could be what gets this train on the tracks. And after that call or email or message comes in, 3 months from now, they could be announcing that the case has been solved. It's been done before. It can happen again. So just in case that person is listening or watching right now, 10-year-old Amy Mihaljevic was abducted after school on October 27th, 1989, from the Bay Village Square Shopping Center in Bay Village, Ohio. More than 3 months later, on February 8th, 1990, Amy's body was found in a remote field in Ashland County, Ohio, roughly 50 miles from where she was taken. Her death was ruled a homicide, but despite decades of investigation, no arrests have ever been made, and Amy's murder remains unsolved. If you have any information about Amy's case, please call the FBI at 1-800-CALL-FBI. There is a $25,000 reward available. My final words, as always, go out to Amy's friends and family, specifically her father, Mark, and her brother, Jason. I know you guys are carrying on the torch for Margaret at this point, but I want you to know you don't have to do it alone. I'm here with you. My community is here with you to support you as well. And we're hoping for justice in this case sooner than later. And if there's anything that I can do, whether it's from the DNA side or even the financial side, where they have something that needs to be tested but just don't have the financial resources, I am available. I'm easy to find. And I really hope that sooner than later, I get the opportunity to sit right here with all of you and let you know that the person responsible for what happened to Amy, they've been caught. And they're going to answer for what they did. Until that day comes, everyone stay safe out there, and I'll see you next week. And before I completely wrap this episode up, I just want to put out there that I am going to a fan event in Florida. It's going to be a cruise where I hope I get to meet some of you guys. I will be back later in the week. It could delay the release of next week's episode by a couple days. I'm hoping it doesn't, but if it does, I'll put that out on my social media. So make sure you're following me there. You guys have a good night. I'll see you soon.